I'm Paul Cherry, and this is The Dark North, Gangs of Montreal. In today's episode, we're going back to the 1980s, when things really changed for Montreal's gangs. And what made it change? Cocaine. At the beginning of the 1980s, Nicolò Rizzuto had taken control of Montreal's mafia after former leader Paolo Violi was shot to death. The Hells Angels had taken over the Popeyes biker gang in Quebec and was expanding by creating new chapters. That was the topic of episode 1 of Gangs of Montreal, if you want to get caught up. The Montreal Mafia and the Hells Angels were already involved in drug trafficking in Montreal. It was easy to get drugs if you wanted them. Pot, hash, heroin. You could get them at bars, nightclubs, your neighborhood dealer. Italian organized crime groups had been importing heroin and hashish from Corsica and France for years. But cocaine took things to a whole different level. We hope you're enjoying The Dark North. You can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. So, back to the 1980s.
Every club on a weekend would go through easily a kilo of coke. Everybody knew where to go buy the coke. It was crazy. You'd walk into a bathroom. Believe me, it wasn't for personal use. It was just a place to consume it.
They got these importations of cocaine coming from, you know, Mexico, Colombia, you name it, was coming in. And into the waterfront, the wharf was crazy. They were bringing in tons of it.
They realized how important was the Rizzuto clan in Montreal.
The guys in Laval were crazy. I mean, they were all stoned. And this is what brought them down.
In the 1980s, Montreal's criminal gang saw a new business opportunity. Cocaine would bring more money than hash and heroin. Ezio Turin was on the Montreal Police Drug Squad for almost a decade.
The heroin was getting very scarce in Montreal. Cocaine came in, all right? It was the rich man's drug. Everybody knows it. But then it got to a price where it was available for everybody. So everybody and their brother and sister were using cocaine. Only thing that they forgot is when they stop using cocaine, you get the after effects of it. And the price goes up because instead of one hit per week, you're going to 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. You need it every day, blah, 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 to function and whatnot. So cocaine came in very strong.
In Colombia, drug traffickers like Pablo Escobar saw a huge market for cocaine in the United States. He made billions of dollars smuggling drugs out of Colombia and into the U.S. Another person who saw the money cocaine could bring in was Nicolò Rizzuto. Now, the problem with cocaine is that you can't grow coca plants in Canada. So getting cocaine into the country meant smuggling it in from South America. Nicolò Rizzuto had contacts in Venezuela. Two other crime families from Sicily who had experience trafficking in heroin. Rizzuto used that network to start moving cocaine. Andre Cedillo was a longtime journalist with the Montreal newspaper La Presse. He covered organized crime in Montreal and wrote a book about it called Mafia Inc. Cedillo says the Rizzuto organization had a more international approach than the Catroni family they replaced at the head of Italian organized crime in Montreal.
They began to negotiate with the Colombians furnishers of cocaine. In their mind, they said, we have the road to transport heroin from all over the world. We'll take the same road to transport cocaine. That's why in the 80s and even more in the 90s, the cocaine was full in Montreal.
Pietro Paletti is a retired Montreal police officer. For years, he investigated organized crime. He remembers what it was like when cocaine arrived in Montreal in the early 1980s.
There was a lot of prosperity, wealth. Cocaine was all over the place. We'd raid clubs and we'd find 40 envelopes on the floor. It was crazy. It was another era.
In 1985, the manager of the St. Louis Cardinals baseball team said he'd only let his players fly into Montreal for the first day of a series against the Expos. Whitey Herzog said he was trying to keep the guys away from coke in the city. It got so bad that when we went to Montreal, which was where they all seemed to get it, I had to have us fly in on the day of the game, Herzog told the Washington Post. That way, I knew we'd play decent for one night, even though the rest of the trip might be a lost cause.
Every club on a weekend would go through easily a kilo of coke. easily. If it wasn't the Irish, it was the Italians distributing to the doorman or the waiters. Everybody knew where to go buy the cocaine. It was crazy. You'd walk into a bathroom. Believe me, it wasn't for personal use. It was just a place to consume. On the bars, we'd walk in after hours clubs. It was all over the place, cocaine. And that changed the fabric of organized crime. We haven't seen a seizure, and I think in 15, 20 years, of more than 50 kilos. There were seizures of 300 kilos, 400, 5 tons. There was so much of it. Profits were enormous, enormous. That's where the money came from.
Cocaine was a real moneymaker for Montreal's criminal gangs. A gram of cocaine, lighter than a single sheet of paper, sold for between $100 and $150 in the mid-1980s in Montreal. In 1983 alone, police estimated nearly $1 billion of coke had been brought into Canada. And police admitted they were only seizing about 10% of what was coming into the country. John Westlake was an investigator with the Montreal Police Drug Squad. He says there was so much money to be made from cocaine that organized crime was bringing it into the country any way it could.
They got these importations of cocaine coming from, you know, Mexico, Colombia, you name it, was coming in. Into the waterfront, the wharf was crazy. They were bringing in tons of it, you know, down in the States at the end of the warm weather. People coming home in May, seniors would be offered $20,000, $30,000. Give us your RV for a day. We'll pay you, no questions asked. You will never get stopped. You'll never be arrested. And that's easy money for some seniors who could use that money.
Smugglers put cocaine on planes, boats, and trucks. They had all kinds of ways of hiding it. Inside flower boxes that were to be delivered to a Montreal flower shop, stuffed in bags that were hidden inside car door panels, even inside people. Dozens of travelers were stopped at the Montreal area airports every year and searched for packets of cocaine they had ingested to smuggle into the city. Cocaine changed the way organized crime groups operated in Montreal. Instead of fighting amongst themselves for a piece of the pie, they worked together to share it. The Rizzutos had the contacts in South America to get the coke. The West End Gang, a group of mainly Irish criminals based in the West End of the city, controlled the port of Montreal. They gave criminals a way to get the drug into the city. The West End Gang was so involved in cocaine smuggling that its leader, Dooney Ryan, came to be known as the King of Coke. The West End Gang was known for daring bank robberies and safe-cracking. It's believed that's how they financed their drug purchases. The Hells Angels, meanwhile, took care of the logistics, getting the coke to Canada by air, land, or sea.
That's why then the Hells Angels become a very well-structured criminal organization with money. Then they make money. The West End Gang make money. The Italian make money. The Colombian family in Montreal make money. Everybody make money. A lot of people out in Montreal, they are very rich.
The Rizzutos began gobbling up real estate. They bought into a new real estate development carved out of a forest in northern Montreal. They used the land to build luxury homes. They were all lined up on one side of the street, which became known as Mafia Row. Niccolo Rizzuto's only son, Vito, drove Jaguars and Mercedes. He played golf at courses around the world. The Rizzutos deposited their money in Swiss bank accounts. The leader of the West End Gang, Dooney Ryan, would hold court in a West End bar and was known for handing out fur coats and money. He was a flashy dresser who owned a yacht and a home in Montreal's West Island. Also, during the 1980s, the Hells Angels Sherbrooke chapter somehow bought a sprawling piece of land high on a hill that overlooked Wellington Street, the main street through Sherbrooke. The location gave the gang privacy, but also showed that they should be taken seriously as a criminal organization. It was because of cocaine that Canadian police learned that Vito Rizzuto was running the Montreal Mafia. And they discovered that by accident, thanks to a shipment of cocaine they found in Vancouver in 1984. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police had seized 12 kilograms of cocaine hidden in suitcases at the Vancouver airport. They were trying to figure out who it belonged to.
And then they follow the trail to Montreal and they find Sam Nicolucci.
Nicolucci was a Montreal drug trafficker. The police knew Nicolucci had visited Vito Rizzuto at his home a few months earlier. so they decided to watch him more closely. Not long after, Nicolucci went to the Montreal airport and headed to Venezuela. To the RCMP's surprise, Vito Rizzuto and his wife got on the same plane.
The RCMP went to Venezuela, and then they discovered that the Rizzuto family, they were involved a lot in drug trafficking, and they were well known in Venezuela, and they were very, very important, you know. Not only in that country, but in the States, they have contact in the States, they have contact in Canada, they have contact in Italy, they have contact in Swiss, and everywhere, you know that.
The Venezuelan police told the RCMP that the Rizzutos were one of several Sicilian criminal organizations trafficking drugs and laundering money. The first stop Nicolucci made when he landed in Venezuela was to visit Vito's father, Nicolo. Nicolo Rizzuto had been living in South America since the late 1970s when he was clashing with the leaders of the Montreal Mafia. Nicolucci went to a hotel in Caracas which had been paid for by the Contrera Caruanas, the Sicilian drug traffickers that worked with Nicolo Rizzuto. The police had bugged the hotel room, and they heard Nicolucci talking with Vito Rizzuto. Andre Cetolo wrote about Rizzuto's trip to Venezuela in his book, Mafia Inc. He described what the Venezuelan police heard in the wiretapped hotel room. Rizzuto talked about the election of a new president in the country. "They've got a new president," Rizzuto said. "We've lost our contacts, but it'll only be a few weeks and everything will be back to normal." Cetolo said that operation showed the RCMP how big of a role Vito Rizzuto was playing in Montreal.
When they heard Vito Rizzuto talking secretly with Nicolucci, they realized that how important they were. Even they are involved in politics, you know.
Nicolucci was arrested later that year on drug trafficking charges. But the RCMP did not have enough evidence to charge Vito Rizzuto. Police searched his home in North End, Montreal. They found nothing to link him to the cocaine that had been found in Vancouver. Rizzuto repeatedly outsmarted the Canadian legal system. Twice in the 1980s, Rizzuto was charged with attempting to smuggle a total of 48 tons of hash into Canada. One of the cases was heard in Sept-Îles, a tiny town on Quebec's lower north shore. That's where Rizzuto was acquitted after a police informant changed his mind and decided not to testify. The other case was handled in Newfoundland. Rizzuto was acquitted after a judge declared that several telephone conversations the RCMP had recorded were illegal. When Rizzuto walked out of the courtroom in St. John's, he told reporters, "One word can mean so much, especially when that word is acquittal." Vito Rizzuto's nickname among his associates was the Tall One. It was a sign of how physically imposing he appeared. He stood at 6 feet 2 inches tall. He stood out in any crowd, but often appeared to be a man who paused to think before he spoke. When asked by a couple of reporters what he did for a living, after denying that he was the godfather of Montreal, he smiled, and he said that he was an arbitrator for his community.
In the underworld, there's a lot of conflict, and you need somebody to arbitrate. And that was the job of Vito at that time, you know, the conflict inside the mafia, between families and the mafia, with the Hells Angels and the mafia. The only aim for everybody, we have to make money. And if we have conflict, we don't make money. We have police on our back, and we don't make business.
While things were running smoothly for the Montreal Mafia, it was a totally different story for the Hells Angels. By 1984, the Hells Angels had expanded from 1 to 3 chapters in Quebec. There was the Montreal chapter, which operated out of a clubhouse in the town of Sorel, outside the city. And there were chapters in Laval, north of Montreal, and in Sherbrooke, south of the city. The three chapters bought cocaine together and then split it three ways to sell it in areas that they controlled. But coke was causing trouble for the Hells. The biker gang had a strict rule: no drug use. A rule the Laval chapter was ignoring. Instead of selling coke, they were using it. And the chapter was spinning out of control. Andre Butch Bouchard is a retired Montreal police officer and former head of the city's homicide squad.
"The guys in Laval were crazy. I mean, they were all stoned. And this is what brought them down."
Yves Apache Trudeau was one of the first members of the Hells Angels in Montreal. and he became part of the Laval chapter. He was also one of the Laval Hells Angels who were using coke. In fact, he said he was so addicted to it, he had gone through $60,000 worth of it in just 3 weeks.
Apache Trudeau, I mean, he ended up being one of the most prolific killers, you know, and he was a tough guy. I mean, he was a tough guy, but the rest of them were idiots, all on drugs, all of them. They'd go and they'd cause so much trouble in parties and bars and this and that, that the cops would come and they'd throw them out. And so the name wasn't very good.
The Laval chapter wasn't keeping track of its cocaine sales and was asking the other chapters to help out when their suppliers started demanding to be paid. It was creating headaches with the other gangs the Hells Angels were doing business with. Then, the Laval chapter stole from the Hells Angels' new chapter that had just been set up in Halifax. While one witness said that the Laval chapter stole money from them, the former leader of the Hells Angels in Quebec later said that it was actually a large amount of cocaine. It was all giving the Hells Angels a bad name in the criminal underworld. The Montreal chapter, which ran the Hells operations in Quebec, had had enough. The leaders ordered the assassination of 7 members of the Laval chapter. In March 1985, Laval bikers were invited to a get-together at the gang's clubhouse in Lennoxville, a tiny town just outside of Sherbrooke, Quebec. Dozens of bikers were there. They went inside a building on the Hells Angels property. And 5 of the Laval Hells Angels were shot. Their bodies were wrapped in sleeping bags and attached to cinder blocks and then dumped into the St. Lawrence River near Berthierville, about 80 kilometers east of Montreal. It became known as the Lennoxville Purge. There were 2 other Laval Hells Angels who were supposed to be killed that day. One was killed 5 years later after leaving a country and western bar south of Montreal. The other was the coke-addicted Apache Trudeau, who had checked into a drug rehab center days before the other Laval Hells Angels were murdered.
When they killed the guys in 1985 in Lennoxville, Apache didn't like that. When it happened, he was pissed. He was very angry that was against all moral standards of motorcycle. You don't kill another brother. You can put him out without good standing, but you don't kill him unless it's, you know, something special. And yet they killed him. So he got pissed.
Trudeau realized his days were numbered, and he went to the police. He confessed to being a hitman, admitting to having killed 43 people. He went out to testify at a public inquiry into the Lennoxville purge. Trudeau said cocaine was behind the killings. He was paid $50,000 for his information and given a new identity. But nearly 20 years later, his cover was blown when he was arrested for sexually abusing a 4-year-old boy. He was sent to jail for 4 years. In the wake of the Lennoxville purge, 3 other Hells Angels members or hangarounds had become police informants. Their testimony at a public inquiry shed light on the biker gang's operations in Quebec and elsewhere in Canada. It took years for the Hells to recover from the aftershocks of the Lennoxville purge. The gang was in disarray until a charismatic biker named Maurice Mumboucher took over in the 1990s. The Lennoxville purge had repercussions for other Montreal gangs. By the end of the 1980s, the West End gang had gone from a loose group of bank robbers and truck thieves to international drug smugglers. Next time on Gangs of Montreal.
When the cops found him, the driver was there, and the steering wheel, the Brinks truck was empty. It was a large amount, the biggest amount that had ever been robbed from the Brinks company in North America, and certainly the biggest robbery in Montreal. And this was at a time when Montreal was known as the bank robbery capital of North America.
If you are the king, you got power. You have a lot of money, you got power. And with that money and power, you can do particularly what you want, to do anything to anyone, and to keep that power.
The Dark North, Gangs of Montreal, is written and produced by Monique Baudin and me, Paul Cherry. Additional production and editing by Carson Jarama. Theme music is by Bryce Hall. Emma McKay is the Montreal Gazette's digital executive producer, and Lucinda Choden is our editor-in-chief. You can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.